gonna read from Afterlands, a historical novel based mainly on an event of the 1870s in which 19 men, women, and children, a white American, a black American, an Englishman, 5 Germans, a Dane, a Swede, and 2 Inuit families, were cast adrift on a large ice floe in the high Arctic, which then began drifting slowly southward through the Arctic seas, slowly disintegrating, shrinking, forcing them closer and closer together even as they split apart along ethnic and national lines. The section I'm going to read takes place when they've been on the floe for about a month and they're already starving. Sleep on the ice was protracted but shallow, shredded by jittery dreams and wakings, but that night Kruger and the men in their snow hut must have slept better, the seas below the floe almost placid, because later nobody could say whether the domed roof had caved in and the white bear had found them there exposed, or the bear with black razored paw had sliced away the peak of the dome like the top of a boiled egg, meaning to scoop out the insides. Kruger came awake to a babel of panic, everyone reverting to his own tongue. The bear's eyes and the lamp's glow were reptilian, and its massive skull outlined with stars. But had it really been slavering and roaring down like a fairy-tale dragon through a castle's shattered roof? Others would later describe a medley of horrific sounds, but, as Kruger retold it, the bear had gone about its business with a sort of laconic reserve, a demeanor of unhurried and routine competence. If there had been any roaring, it had come from the men. The bear's jaws never opened and its eyes never blinked. Its face was thoughtful, Roman-nosed, something almost surgical in its manner as it worked a white-coated arm over the edge of the hole and started probing down at the men trapped on the bed ledge, their backs flinched up hard against the walls. Count Meyer, he was still addressed as Mister then, was trying to pull on his spectacles with one hand while jabbering orders, who had moved his revolver. He was rummaging in the furs. Kruger and Anting and Lundquist and Linderman were all driving their fists into the walls, trying to punch through into the outer cold and feel for the rifles staked butt down in the snow. This was before the rift between the parties, or the nations, as the Count was to call them, deepened to the point where the men began keeping their firearms inside with them at night, despite the moisture, and a week after they had roasted the last of the dogs that would have warned them of the bear. Jackson, the black cook, had dug out his cleaver and was waving it experimentally at the paw. In that cavern light, the blade looked rusted, dull, and small. Was a yellowed plush paw about the size of a young seal. It foraged closer while the men who had guns kept reaching outside, arms through to the shoulders like horse doctors feeling for foals, and Kruger, as he groped, was swearing, "Scheiße, scheiße, verdammt noch mal, wo bist du?" The casual treachery of inanimate things. Now Madsen was yelling for help to a Birbing and Hans Christian and Tyson and the other snow huts, and Jamka was whimpering, giggling. Somebody sneezing repeatedly. Lundquist leaning back with his Springfield angled up, loading. He must have just pulled it inside, a clump of snow still in the sights. And the bear got its claws on the jerking leg of the steward, Heron, who started poking at it with a penknife. Kruger's hand outside closed on the freezing stock of his rifle. Lundquist's rifle, aimed at the bear's head, clicked coldly, nothing, and Lundquist cocked the hammer again and again nothing. "Get me another fucking round," he said hoarsely in Swedish, and Kruger understood him, but was too busy twisting his own rifle in through the wall butt first and cracking the breech and fumbling a cartridge into the groove and swinging it round and up and cocking the hammer with the side of his palm, because his thumb was too cold. He aimed at the bear's cool, attentive face, beneath which little Heron was squirming and making farmyard sounds, dagger-like claws barbed in his breeches, dragging him down off the bed ledge into the center of the hut, upending the lamp so that it flared up and then died. The rifle fired in the dark. The brace plate thumped Kruger in the starved hollow of his gut. He curled on the ledge, both hands gripping his navel, while the men around him, on their feet donning their furs, began the celebrations. There's a pitch of joy, fierce and pure, primordial, unique to the truly desperate. They would butcher the animal now in the middle of the night, and they would feast, their beards and teeth and lips lacquered with blood. Greedy faces underlit by the refueled blubber lamps. A Paleolithic scene. A Birbing and Hans Christian could be heard outside conferring in their clicking tongue, and now Tekulida was there, her composed, melodious voice, the first thing about her Kruger had loved. "Are all the men quite well, Mr. Meyer?" And then Tyson. "I warned you this snow hut would not hold, Mr. Meyer." And 2 of the Eskimo children crying, "Nanuk, Tuavilauriti." Kruger sat up to receive a mug of foaming blood from a jolly-looking Heron. Heron, whose squinty eyes used to vanish into his plump, port-colored cheeks with every grin. Now his hag face with gory lips and beard leaned in to kiss Kruger on the nose. In English, Kruger asked after his leg, and as Heron replied at length, again his garrulous self, though his teeth jittered and his Scouse accent had thickened, Kruger nodded, winced a smile, and drank the blood.